we have conversations, and I mean, it's a rabbi existential question about the difficulty of confronting the fact that, you know, we're all going to die someday. And it's kind of hard to hear, but it's the only sure thing in life, because I'm told some people don't pay taxes. But it's the only thing we can't avoid. So the question is, and the important thing to know is, we cannot control if we die, but we can control how we die. And where, and with whom. And every day I'm working in the ICU, I'm confronted with people in an environment where it's not what they wanted. We have pumps and IVs and monitors, we have beeps, and we have things happening in the rooms next door, and there's announcements overhead, and the blood pressure cuff, and there's visiting hour restrictions, and it's not sort of what was meant to be. But because we all kind of have a difficult time as human beings sort of confronting this reality, then we kind of put it off and we don't think about it. So the question, when should hospice or palliative care be discussed? I think the answer is if you or your patient or your loved one has a diagnosis for which there is no absolute cure, right? I mean, there are a lot of conditions now. Medicine has gotten very good at curing the things we can cure and then sort of maintaining everything else for a certain amount of time. If you have that diagnosis, whatever it is, that's the time to have a discussion. And I think a lot of family members or patients have this idea that if they commit to hospice, it's like this, you know, it's like signing up for a timeshare. Like, you just can't get out of it. Like, there's no turning back, right? It's not. I mean, I've had patients who are discharged from hospice. I've had patients who've gone to palliative care clinics for 2 years, right? It's not a, you don't have to, like, you're not committing to anything, right? But what you're making a recognition or an acknowledgement of the fact that we as human beings, we as physicians can only do so much. And sometimes we get to a point where the more we do, you know, listen, I can keep people alive on a machine for a long time. I can put long-term IVs, I can put them on a ventilator, I can keep their heart pumping, I can keep their blood chemistry good, but I can't make them happy, right? But when people make a decision for something like hospice or palliative care, they're saying, listen, I understand that there are things beyond my control, right? There are powers beyond where I can interact with, or I can manipulate. And I'm recognizing that even though there is a limit to the length of my life, I have a tremendous amount of control of the how, of the where, even if I can't control the when. So the answer, I think, is if you think about it, or if you're concerned, you ask, and you go into it, and you find out that maybe you're not ready. That's fine. Or if you go into the process of palliative care services or hospice services, you may find out that, well, it's been a few months, and you're doing okay. Well, we'll send you out, and we're here when you need us. And I think that's the thing, because I see every day what happens to people when they make the decision too late. And it's not just the patients that suffer. I see family members that suffer, having to make decisions that is just gut-wrenching decisions for their relatives and their loved ones that, had their loved ones made the decision before, it would have spared them a lot of that. And so if you're thinking about it, then you should refer.
Absolutely. And one of the important things to remember is you're never, as a physician, as a provider, you're never completely alone. You know, there are, you can always, almost every hospital in Maryland now has a palliative medicine team who can be consulted for those patients who are in the hospital. And even in the outpatient setting, there are more and more palliative care clinics, and the hospice medical directors, whether from Seasons or Gilchrist, if you have a question, if you want to know, is this patient appropriate for hospice, don't hesitate to reach out to the medical directors at the various hospices, because they'll be happy to talk it through with you. One of the take-home points that I learned was, if you're wondering, you're probably right. If you're thinking, would it surprise me if this person, if my patient died in the next year or the next 2 years? You're probably right. You should be asking that question, and it may be time to start. It's certainly time to start broaching the subject with the patient, but also maybe making a referral. So thanks. Do you have anything to add?
I always have something to add. I would just kind of to pick up on what Dan was saying, this idea of, and again, obviously I can't speak to it from the practitioner's perspective, but I think one thing that's exceptionally important is destigmatizing or demystifying death. You know, we have a natural and inherent reluctance to speak about death. And on a very deep level, often that comes from a misunderstanding of what death is. You know, when one opens up the book of Genesis, so we often assume or we associate death with the sin of Adam and Chava, with the sin of Adam and Eve. They ate from the tree they weren't supposed to, and as such, a man was condemned to die. But when one looks among the commentaries, you'll notice something very interesting, that death was always part of the fabric of the human condition. We were always supposed to die. Unfortunately, what the sin of Adam and Eve introduced was the concept of premature or tragic death. But man was always supposed to die. Immortality was never in the cards. And there's a very good reason for that. Because what makes life precious, what makes life important, is the fact that it is a finite, non-renewable resource. Meaning, if we were immortal, imagine what your garage would look like. Right? And imagine, again, we know the problems we have with procrastination. Now that we, God willing, we all lived until 120, imagine if, again, life was limitless. So this idea, and I think as Dan was mentioning very beautifully, to begin the discussion, you know, I'll tell you an interesting thing. We know that in the Hebrew month of Av, right before the Jewish New Year, we have a period of mourning that we call the 3 weeks. And it's during that time that we mourn the destruction of the first two temples. We mourn many different calamities that occurred to the Jewish people over the last 2,000 years. And I remember that one year I wanted to teach the laws of Avelus, the laws of mourning. Because halacha, Jewish law, has a voluminous amount of information regarding the laws of mourning. The difficulty is most of us only begin to look at the laws of mourning when we're thrust into the throes of loss. And during that time, there's so much else going on emotionally, spiritually, physically, that it's difficult to comprehend all of the laws. And I'll tell you something interesting, that I got such a visceral reaction from people about that. Almost like you would have thought I was teaching the New Testament. This idea that people were so averse to the concept of learning the laws of mourning while everything was okay. How can you do that? It doesn't look good. It's not right. It's an ayin hara. It's an evil eye. All the different kinds of things. And meanwhile, if you don't prepare yourself for the eventuality of death, you can't live impactfully. One of the greatest motivators for to live a life of carpe diem, of seizing the day, of seizing the moment, is the notion that we know not how much time we have on this earth. It's true from a spiritual perspective, and it's true from a medical perspective as well. If we accept the fact that we all die, then at the end of the day, it's important to prepare. And I would say, the truth is, I would, not that I'm disagreeing with my medical, not my colleagues, but the medical staff here, I think the conversation begins much, much earlier than the time when you're ill. The time to do it is when a person is preparing for their estate plan, a person is preparing their will, a person is preparing a whole host of documents. I often encourage my congregants to sign what's called a halachic living will, which is that if a person wants their end-of-life decisions made in conformance with Jewish law, there are documents that you could sign that are legally binding, that go into your medical records, and that ultimately govern how the hospital and how the doctors treat you. That's not a conversation to have when you're 50, 60, 70, 80. It's a conversation to have when you're 30 or you're 40. And the more we're prepared, the more we embrace this reality, number one, it revitalizes us to lead more invigorated and impactful lives. It allows us to make our decisions in a proactive fashion and allows us to be control not only of how we live, but ultimately how we die.
Talk to your family about what you would want if things were better, even when you're healthy. Because if you do it when you're on this method, you have a much better chance of your family really following your wishes and following the way you would want to be treated. Our next question, how might I introduce the topic of hospice or palliative care to my patient? You want to
Want to start?
Sure. As I was stating earlier, that you know, it occurs in different stages, so I think it depends on the context and circumstances. How do I like to do it? As Rabbi Silver said, I think that you know, the youngest at the earliest stage possible in preparing people to think about living wills, identifying a durable power of attorney, helping them to have discussions around how these decisions look. You know, what under what kind of circumstances would somebody choose, in fact, to have or would be delegated, if you will, their decision making to a caregiver, a child, a spouse, and have those kinds of conversations. So those come up. I think we do try to initiate that. As I mentioned earlier, unfortunately, it often occurs in the context of illness. And so, therefore, it's a very delicate conversation because the last thing that I want someone to think is that I'm giving up hope for them. Because as Dan mentioned, there are many things that we can do. As Aaron mentioned earlier, there's a lot that we can do in palliation. And the back studies, and said, show that in those circumstances, many times people will thrive. They'll do better. They may live longer. Back studies have shown, Diane Myers at Sinai in New York, studies there have shown that individuals actually live longer once they enrolled in hospice compared to the controls that were not at the same level of illness, same functional status, and were not enrolled in hospice. So I think that is a delicate conversation to have, but to preserve the realization that you're not giving up what you're present for them. And I think in the most difficult situations of all are the ones that alluded to earlier with the example of the woman who I just left at bedside. She doesn't know me. And trust is the most valuable commodity in any human transaction. Without trust, you know, no matter how much skill, competence we have, whatever our degrees or training, mean very little. And so in this woman's case, you have to sit down with somebody and in a very heartfelt way begin to develop a relationship. Which surprisingly you can do even in a very short period of time, but it's not going to be as deep. It's not going to be as meaningful as one that we've had as an individual person that you've gotten to know over a long period of time. But it's incumbent on us, and we have to develop that skill. And I would say that some, you know, as part of your professional experience and you develop that skill, then, you know, then you're the right person to do that. But where you're not, and in many cases, you know, colleagues may not feel comfortable with that. There are palliative care specialists. In the case that I just was referring to, we worked with David Wood, one of our new palliative care physicians, to also have a conversation around some of the technical aspects of hospice. So I think that that's where help comes in, and our Jewish patients' rabbinical guidance.
So I do the intensive care unit. I have an interesting or sort of unique in my specialty perspective in that I also take care of outpatient pulmonary medicine, and I have a lot of patients with end-stage lung disease who I have a relationship with. And I get to contrast the conversations that I have with the patients in the office and the conversations I have with the families in the intensive care unit. And it's sort of night and day. The surprising thing I remember when I first came out of training was that a lot of times we feel, maybe as physicians, I feel awkward bringing up the subject to deal with this sort of elephant in the room of our mortality, especially when I'm the one who's sort of supposed to make them live longer. But what I found that when I had a relationship with the patients and I brought it up, it was far more of a relief for both of us to have the discussion because they want to talk about it. And they just don't know how. And so when I bring it up with the patients, they're almost always grateful and happy that we have something to discuss or a plan in the office. In the ICU, it's a little bit of a different discussion because usually you're dealing with the family who are often distraught and shocked and overwhelmed, and it's much more delicate, but I generally try to bring up the idea of our job in the ICU is to be an advocate for the person who's being cared for and to try to figure out how would they want their final time to be and make sure that we're not prolonging somebody's life or making them suffer because we're having a hard time dealing with the reality of the situation. And that's a very difficult conversation to have. That's not a conversation I generally have on the first meeting. We have to establish rapport, see what the family is discussing, is what are their expectations, what are their goals, what are their desires, and kind of address and then see if that the hospice model is something that's in line with what they want and what would be best for their loved one. But that contrast, I think, emphasizes the importance of having a discussion early in the primary care office, in the oncologist office, in the cardiologist office, wherever it is, with the patient that you have a relationship with, and so that it's not, they know, that patient knows that you're not just trying to sort of cut them off or give up on them. They know that you care about them, and then you can have that conversation. They know it's coming from a place that you care about them. They know that, and then they can sort of be receptive, and they almost always are relieved to have the discussion. When you talk to your patients.
You did great.
I think you both brought up excellent points. I think having, as the primary provider out in the community, even just touching on the fact that if, you know, we're going to treat your cancer, for example, but if things don't turn out the way we hope they will, let's talk about what that looks like also. That is a fantastic way to broach the subject, just to, you know, it addresses the elephant in the room, and it allows then, if you've handed off care to the ICU or to the geriatric service or wherever they end up in another hospital, the reflection back is that it's not a brand new thing.
Yeah, we see a lot of patients in the ICU who have sort of late stage, end stage chronic diseases, and I'm having a discussion with the family or the patient saying, you know, what's your understanding of your condition? And they have no idea. They just didn't understand that it was as advanced as it was, and I'm sort of dropping this bomb on them in sort of the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, and it's a difficult thing to do, and that's why it's so important to address these things early on.
Absolutely. One of the fallback services, the Care Choices Program that I addressed briefly, and I think there's a little bit in the handout also, allows, as I said, concurrent care between aggressive, quote-unquote, curative treatments and hospice. So it allows the hospice team to be involved, and while they don't provide all of the service that, quote-unquote, regular hospice would, they don't provide DME, they don't pay for medicine, that's all still covered under Medicare, under the Medicare Parts A, B, and D, but it does allow for the hospice team to get involved, and then transitioning, patients often transition very quickly once they're enrolled in the Care Choices Program because they realize, oh, all these curative treatments aren't making me feel very good, but I've got this team who's there to catch me and to help me and to help me through this. So that is one really thoughtful, if you can imagine it, plan that Medicare put into place. Our next question looks like it's going to go to Rabbi Silver. Is it true that Judaism and Jewish law mandates that one do everything possible to extend life, no matter what the quality of that life may be?
It's a good question. The simple answer whenever you discuss anything about Jewish law is the answer usually is yes and no. Meaning, you know, the complexity of Jewish law, first of all, again, is that it's subject to interpretation. So depending who you ask will ultimately determine the answer. And depending, again, in which stream of Judaism which rabbi you consult will also probably yield you a different answer. So while I can't answer the question on behalf of Judaism, I could give you my opinion on it. So this, I think, is a very commonly held misconception that according to Jewish law, you have to do anything and everything because life and sustaining life at all costs, no matter what the quality of life, is a halachic, is a Jewish law mandate. So that statement in and of itself is true and false. I will say, I think one of the most destructive terms in this whole end-of-life narrative is quality of life. And the reason I say it's a destructive term is because that is a subjective definition. A doctor walks into a room, sees someone hooked up to a machine, and says, this person has no quality of life. Well, what informs your decisions about that? Who are you to say that this person does have a quality of life, doesn't have a quality of life? From a spiritual perspective, we believe that every moment of life in this world is important, is impactful, has incredible and far-reaching effects that often we cannot measure. And that is true sometimes if a person is not communicative, if a person is unable to interact, if a person is sometimes even unable to sustain themselves. At the same time, and again, I'm really addressing this in very broad strokes, because I will tell you the real answer to this question is, I can't answer this question. And the reason I say that is because end-of-life issues have to be dealt with, from a Jewish law perspective, on a case-by-case situation. In some of the earlier iterations of the halachic living will, which essentially is your Jewish advanced directive, so I think one of the earliest ones was put out by Agudas Yisrael. And what they tried to do was script every single end-of-life scenario. If I can breathe on my own, if I'm brain dead, if I could eat, if I could this. And they went through the whole list. And the problem was, I think they used it two times. And it turned out that no case fits the exact criteria. So instead, if you look at most halachic living wills, Jewish law advanced directives, essentially what it says is the following. Let's say the ones that I use in my congregation. It says, I am an Orthodox Jew, and I want my end-of-life decisions made in conformance with Jewish law. And you list three rabbis. Hopefully they like you. Right? You list three rabbis, and again, you say, in the event that I am unable to make my decisions for myself, so please call Rabbi so-and-so. If this one's not available, then the next one, then the next one. And generally, that's how we have to deal with these kinds of situations, because each case is unique. Each situation is different. You know, there are no two health, I mean, the doctors could speak to this much better than I, but my impression as a layman is that no two end-of-life situations are the same. And even if a person is presenting with the same disease and the same symptoms, every person is an individual, and therefore every end-of-life situation has to be dealt with on an individual basis.
Sometimes the same patient is different on a different day.
Very true also, absolutely. So what I would say is, you know, the Talmud records an amazing story. The Talmud tells a story about the great sage Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who's known as Rebbe. And the Talmud discusses that Rebbe, in his final days, was suffering from it seems like some type of debilitating, fatal intestinal disease, to the point that he was in unbearable pain each and every day. There was no cure for it. And this, at the end, this disease was going to claim his life. His wife had already predeceased him. So the Talmud tells an amazing story. He had a caregiver. It sounds like she must have been either the nanny or the housekeeper for a number of years. And she becomes Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's caregiver. So the Talmud tells a story, and you have to imagine this scene. Outside of the home of Rebbe, outside of the home, the students are praying. They're praying that their teacher should recover. And they're holding massive prayer rallies, and everybody's gathered. And this woman, the caretaker, is looking out the window. She sees everybody praying for the great Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the great Rebbe, and she sees the incredible pain that Rebbe is in. She understands that he's in a state of debilitating illness. And but she realizes, however she understood this, that it was the prayers of the masses which were keeping him alive. So she does something amazing. She takes an earthenware pot, she threw it out the window, it crashed on the ground, and in that moment when it shattered, everyone who was assembled for the prayer rally was startled. They stopped praying for that moment, and in that moment, Rebbe passed away. That moment Rebbe passed away. So that story is actually a dramatic one, because that story serves as the basis for a lot of halachic literature regarding removal of end-of-life care. This idea that when someone is suffering with a debilitating end-stage fatal illness, that we don't have to do anything and everything to simply perpetuate life. That we don't say throw everything we have at them for the sake of keeping them alive. So how do we decide when to keep someone alive, when to not keep someone alive? So the simple answer, of course, is that's a case-by-case decision. In a broad stroke, what we say usually is the following. If we could restore a person to some baseline of health, let's say some baseline of where they were previous to the last medical setback, then often halacha, Jewish law, will say that we should do whatever we can. But if at the end of the day, medical intervention will not at all help the individual, but is just simply going to prolong an end-of-life stage, then there would not be a halachic, a Jewish law mandate to intervene and to provide care. But again, I want to give you the caveat that each of these situations must be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. But to address the core question, does Judaism require, or does Jewish law require one to do anything and everything to perpetuate life? So the answer to that, if you're asking yes or no, the answer is no. There are times when you have to do that, and there are times when you don't have to do that. We don't say preserve life at all costs. Again, I will point out from a Jewish law perspective, it is much easier, I use that word, it's not the right word, it is much less halachically Jewish law problematic to abstain from giving care than to remove care. So for example, if God forbid someone is in end stages of illness, it's important that a person ask the question about should we put in a feeding tube or not before you put in the feeding tube. Because once the feeding tube or once the ventilator, once a person is on some type of life-sustaining machinery, the removal of that is much more halachically problematic. Because anything that actively hastens death, anything that actively brings life to a close, unfortunately could be tantamount in Jewish law to bloodshed, and therefore we try to avoid things like this. So kind of looping back to our original question, that's why having these discussions on the front end is so exceptionally important. Because when these decisions have to be made in the heat of the moment, there's so much happening. So many emotions, so many things going on. So there are times when we have to do everything, but there are times also when we can stop in order to allow a person to pass peacefully.
I was going to just make a comment about one thing. I know, Rabbi Silver was talking about, but just to key on one word, that's quality. Because this issue comes up, and I would say it's hot in the secular literature around life in the morning. And there's a Spanish proverb which we like to quote for our medical students anytime this issue comes up around quality, and that is, the bull looks different from the inside of the room. People, you know, very often project themselves, particularly if they're at the young end of life, into someone's situation, and studies have shown that if you do surveys, they'll inevitably say, I never want to live like that. I never want. So one of our colleagues, Bucky Greeno, is a legendary physician at Johns Hopkins, has been managing a chronic ventilatory unit for many, many years now. These are individuals, for a variety of reasons, cannot get off a ventilator. Many of them have Lou Gehrig's disease or similar neuromuscular diseases. And they did a survey of these individuals, and I found this fascinating. Almost all of them not give up a minute of their life. These are people that have had, you know, machines to not only breathe for them, but to, you know, to help them to read the newspaper, what have you. But they value their life. And medical students often find that absolutely mind-blowing. So putting ourselves in someone's shoes and projecting into that and deciding would that be a quality of life or not is a fool's errand. We just can't do that. I just wanted to make that point. The other one is that I'll get calls. Unfortunately, this comes too often from Jewish patients or individuals that are referred to me for whatever reason. Often are out of town. People York, say out of town is here, and here is New York. They call in, they ask a medical question, usually with very little information. And they want to know, what would you do? What should service do? And my answer is, sort of like Rabbi Silver's, but in verses, I can't postulate on that. Every case is different. Every situation is different. It would be like asking a rabbi, you know, is this spoon kosher? You've got to know the detail. And I would say it's the same thing around the medical issues that we often get asked, around very complex issues about should someone not pursue this treatment, is it hopeless, is it not hopeless? Those kinds of questions are possible without really digging in the details. And unfortunately, I think we forget that, you know, as my daughter used to say, we should come home and they shock and we'd ask a question, Jewish question, and she said, it's not simple.
I usually don't have a discussion about quality of life as much as the concept of trying to prevent suffering. I think that's much more clear. Like, you know, I don't know about quality of life. Who knows, right? I mean, so the idea of just trying to alleviate and prevent suffering, and that's what I sort of think of in that frame more than quality.
Could I add one more piece? Just to add one more piece to this, which I think is exceptionally important, both from the physician's perspective and from the patient's perspective, that if a person does find themselves in a hospital in any stage, it's always important to inform your physician, your nurses, about your religious sensitivities. You know, I will tell you, for the last couple of years, we've put together a program with the various schools at University of Maryland as an interprofessional program. And the idea was the concept of whole care. And the concept ultimately that you can't just treat the patient, the doctor can't just treat the patient in a medical way, and the social worker in a social worker way, and the nurse in a nursing way. Everyone has to be able to see the patient in their entirety. And I will tell you that one of the most dramatic revelations I had while participating in this program is how clueless sometimes physicians are, present company excluded, right? About how religious sensitivities inform a person's decision makings. If I am a Jew, I'm not just a Jew on Saturday morning and Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and when I eat a bagel. You know, I'm a Jew at all times, and my religious beliefs, it's not just sensitivities, my beliefs inform everything. They inform what I do from the moment that I'm born, literally until the moment that I die. But it's important to know that a hospital or a doctor or a nurse, they can't be mind readers. And sometimes, again, they don't understand the complexities that go into these end-of-life decisions. Obviously, if you're dealing with a Jewish physician or someone who works with a Jewish population, they may be a little bit more knowledgeable. But even then, I think it's so important to put out there, this is my faith, this is my belief, here are the things that I hold dear, and understand that when I make my end-of-life decisions, these beliefs are going to inform what I do. And if we're going to be a collaborative team in helping either cure me or cure me of my disease, cure me of my suffering, or help me transition to the afterlife in a calm way, I need you to understand my beliefs. I'll never forget when I was a young rabbi. Once upon a time I was a young rabbi. And I was in New Jersey, and I went to visit an elderly congregant in the hospital on a Matzah Shabbos, on a Saturday night. And this man, if I remember, he must have been 99, 100, 101. And I went to see him, and he was shivering. And I was a kid. I had no idea what was happening. I went to see the doctor. So the doctor said, he needs a blood transfusion. And so I said, okay, are you doing it? And he said, listen, it's not going to help. The man is 100 years old. And I said, and again, this was a little bit of chutzpah, I said, what do you mean it's not going to help? There's a human being who's laying in the bed suffering. You can't cure him, but you could alleviate or ameliorate his suffering. And even if it's for 10 minutes, even if it's for 20 minutes, even if it's for a half hour, you have the ability to do that. And to not do that is a shirking of your moral responsibility. It didn't end well after that, but this is New Jersey, right? But You know, my point with this is that we have to be careful with the dialectic of quality of life, because again, I keep coming back to this, because I wage this battle each and every day. Because not every day, but a number of times a week, I will have a conversation with the physician of one of my congregants. Because if one of my congregants is going through something, they want to know that their end-of-life decisions are being made in conformance with Jewish law. And if they're not necessarily versed in that, they'll lean on me to do that. And the notion that a physician or anyone thinks that they could determine what is a quality of life that is worthy of sustaining is the worst form of arrogance and hubris. And the good part is that the patient has the ability to control that. No one could define what your quality of life is. No one could define the parameters of your care. No one, I mean in a religious sense, no one could tell you what your beliefs should or should not be. And the more that we're forthcoming, and the more we understand, and this loops back to the beginning, the more we understand the nature of how we may have to make our end-of-life decisions, the more we could also give that over to those who are our medical team, to those who are helping us in these last stages, to be able to ensure that not only is our body looked after, but the decisions we're making for the end of life are good for our soul as well.
Our next question is open to the group. What do you think the community role is in supporting patients and families at the end of life?
I mean, I think that you have, everybody has older relatives, everybody has older friends, everybody can, I mean, your role in defining older life, you can go home and you can fill out your advanced directives, you can do your powers of attorney, you can have discussions with your relatives, you know, you have an elderly loved one who, you know, has issues, like, I can't even tell you how great it would be if you had a discussion with them, as opposed to me having to have a discussion with them. Because you know them better than I do, and you love them more than I do, and it's coming from a place where you can say, listen, you're doing your loved ones a favor. If you yourself make these decisions in advance, I cannot express to you how much you are taking a burden off your family. Right? Because like Rabbi Silver says, you know, when I'm in the ICU, I can't make quality of life decisions for patients. And by sort of American legal ethics and medical ethics, I am sort of forced to rely on the surrogate decision makers to have those decisions based on what they think the patient was. And I'm not allowed to stand in the way of that. And I don't. But how much better would it be if you could have that discussion on your own? And you can tell your family members, this is what I want. This is how I want my end to be. I don't want to be put in a position to suffer in this way. Then what you're doing is, as a community, then you're sort of spreading the word, right? And now kind of reaches a critical mass where, you know, actually there's a town in Wisconsin, I think it's La Crosse, Wisconsin, where there was a physician in the health system who made it his mission to get everybody in the community to fill out their advanced directives. And that town has about 97% of their population that has advanced directives. And I heard a radio program describing it. There was a couple who was going to a dinner party at their neighbors down the street, and their neighbors were part of the 3%. And they were bringing with them the paperwork to have the discussion. And the idea that I don't know what the statistics are in Baltimore. It ain't 97%, I can tell you that much. But the idea is that as more and more people recognize the fact that you know, these are important decisions to make when you can, when you're healthy, when it's not relevant, then the word will spread. You know, your aunt, your uncle, your father, and then they'll get their kids to do it, and we'll all kind of get it done together. We can have these discussions. It's good for, you know, synagogue attendance when we start thinking about end of life. You know. And we can find a way that can also build bonds in the community for allowing us to have these discussions in a way that, you know, what does it do to a family relationship when a child and a parent are able to sit down and have a discussion about that difficult topic? How does that bring that family together? And how does that enhance those bonds and relieve a burden and like, take that elephant out of the room, relieve that stress on the relationship? So I think that's the way that as a community that we can sort of foster this discussion is have a discussion, right? Have the discussion at home with your spouse, with your children, with your parents, with whoever it is, and let that sort of take hold so we don't have to have the decisions in my ICU or in the hospital when it's much more difficult.
So, let Dan speak first because I wasn't sure what to say. I'm still not sure. But what I was thinking about when you asked the question was from a little bit of a different angle. I heard in a different context the other day that in the United States, one of the last bastions or institutions that brings together the collective group that are Americans is a hospital. And that was sad to me, because what that meant was that it displaced religious organizations, religious community. But then I thought about it, and I'd have a hard time explaining this to colleagues that I work with. They don't understand or know about this amazing community. It's Baltimore. I'm sure there's this kind of place that I've lived in some Jewish communities, but it's an amazing community. It actually is. We're having this kind of conversation. It's got the density that it's got. It's, you know, the Associated brings together a whole spectrum of Jews from their backgrounds and practice and so forth. And we still have the religious institutions that bring together community. That's different, apparently, demographically than the rest of the United States. So I think that when I was thinking about the question, I think that we have forums. Rabbi Howard, I know in our synagogue, brought this up as a topic. I imagine it was a topic that was another way to talk and get together. And I would imagine that there was a time when there was a decision that this was going to be a discussion. And I think this is the kind of discussion that we can take advantage of and leverage our religious community. And I'm using that term in the broadest sense of the word because, as Rabbi Silver said, it's everything, you know, our whole life is infused with our Yiddishkeit. And birth, which is celebrated, but death, which is part of it, is all something that we ought to be thinking about and discussing. So I don't know organizationally what the best way is, but we have a foundation for that. And I think that the more, as Daniel's saying, that these discussions are made part of you know, the living, regular conversation, whether it's around the Shabbos table, Thanksgiving, Todah, yes, any of those opportunities, I think, are times when discussion can be brought up, and then perhaps just opening the door. It doesn't have to ruin the turkey necessarily, but it could be the beginning or the way in which people think about that. I think, as I said, this is a remarkable community, and you know, we have a certain advantage that I only wish more people had.
Just to add, first of all, don't bring advanced directives to dinner parties. I want to just put that out there. I think it's a bad idea. But certainly finding the other opportunities to use it, as it is in Madrega. I think in terms of the role of community, I think there's just a simpler idea, which is we have the concept, you know, one of the pillars in our religion is the pillar of chesed, the pillar of kindness. And one of the ways in which we exhibit kindness is Bikur Cholim, is visiting the sick. You know, the only thing worse than dying is dying alone. And when people have protracted illness, it takes an incredible toll on a family. It takes an incredible toll on caregivers. You know, when a person is part of a dedicated familial unit, you don't want to leave your loved one alone. But at the same time, at a certain point in time, you have to go back to work. At a certain point in time, you have to assume regular day-to-day responsibilities. If you know someone who either themselves is suffering with illness or has a family member suffering with illness, the ability to say, you know what, I'm happy to spend a little bit of time with your loved one in the hospital. I'm happy to sit with them a little bit. I'm happy to visit with them. I'm happy to go to the hospice. And you know, the great part is people often are very nervous to do these kind of things for one simple reason. What do you wonder about? What are we going to talk about? And you know, people sometimes say the silliest things in an effort to try to have something to talk about. But anyone knows that if you've ever been in a stressful or difficult or overwhelming situation, you don't need someone to say something to you. All you need to know is that they're present. The notion that somebody is sitting by your bedside, the notion that somebody is there, you could be checking your email, you could be doing whatever it is that you want, but that you're there, that you're there, that you're present, I can't even begin to describe the incredible impact that has on people. So the role of community, again, yes, thank God we are part of an exceptional community with incredible organizations and an incredible framework of kindness and of goodness, but nothing ever replaces what the individual can do. And the ability to, if you know someone who is struggling with illness, hospital or hospice, to show up for a visit, to show up and just pop in for a few moments, even if you have nothing to say. You know, the rabbis, the Talmud quotes that when you visit someone, when a person performs the mitzvah of Bikur Chol and visiting someone, the Talmud says you take 1/60th of their illness. 1/60th of their illness. So some of the commentaries on the Talmud says, well, what does that mean? So that means if 60 people show up at once, so that means again the person is going to be cured. So the commentaries explain it's a metaphor. And what it means is that when you feel you're not alone, when you feel that you're not isolated, when you feel that you haven't been forgotten, that has a comprehensively positive and cathartic effect on the individual. That's what the community can do. And it doesn't require money. It doesn't require fundraising. It doesn't require anything except clearing your schedule for a few minutes just to be there for the other.
Last question. How can I address some of the religious concerns my patient may bring up? I guess we only have a short period of time. I think one answer is we can ask about it. I think that's step one. After that?
Absolutely. I think, as I just mentioned before, if from a physician's perspective, you could ask about it. From the patient's perspective, be forthcoming. You know, I will tell you that it does happen sometimes that when patients express their religious beliefs, they feel a little bit like they're looked at as being anachronistic, not in sync with the times, out of sync. You know, this comes up very often. In Jewish law, there's a major debate about end of life. Do we go with a cardiac definition of death, brainstem definition of death? I think the standard that's accepted in most hospitals is the Harvard criteria for brainstem death. But yet again, many in the Orthodox community still subscribe to a cardiac definition of death. And unfortunately, sometimes when they share this information, so a physician or healthcare provider may look at them as ill-informed. And it's important for a person, I'm not ill-informed, I'm just religious. And so if a person goes there, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. A person should be proud of their religious convictions, proud of their religion. In the same way that if a person were to go into the hospital and a person is allergic to some type of medication, everyone would be forthcoming about that allergy. Because if you're not, then your treatment is compromised. If you have religious beliefs, you have religious values, it's important to share that with those who are ministering your care so that they could be sensitive to who you are and what you are and could treat you in a holistic fashion.
Thank you all for your excellent
Please join me in thanking Dr. Aaron Charles and all of our panelists. We really appreciate you spending the evening with us, and everybody wants to hang out for some questions. I know some people need to leave, but if you have questions for our panelists, they would be happy to answer them after the program. I am Dixie Laycock, co-chair of Maimonides Society. Robert wanted me to joke that I was going to clean out my garage tomorrow, if you remember the But what makes that actually funny is Neil and I are pharmacists, we own three pharmacies, and my garage is full of medication carts, so if anyone in the room could actually help me with that project. We also have fish and popcorn for the physicians in our area that we're getting ready to deliver for the holidays. So I did actually think that joke was appropriate for me. Because I can clear it right out in two quick steps. We hope you found tonight's panel discussion informative and meaningful. We were excited.